Hi, this is John, and we are here at the 2019 Rocky Mountain Arch Top Festival here in Arvada, Colorado. And I have the distinct pleasure of sitting down with Mr. Jimmy Bruno, one of my actual favorite jazz guitarists and educator.
That's always good to hear that.
Is it good?
Yeah.
You want me to say something else? I can find
out. Yeah, that's, man, geez, boy, now I have to play good.
Now,
I got to teach good now, you know?
Teach good. Well, your English is doing really good. And a lunch companion. So we're sharing a lunch and we're hanging and doing the thing. We're here in Colorado at the first ever Rocky Mountain Archtop Festival. And Jimmy, you know, tell me a little about what, first of all, what brought you here? What made you decide you wanted to come all the way out here for the festival since it's the first one?
Well, I've been a fan of Henriksen amps for even before Peter was running the family, that the company. I mean, I knew his father, Bud. And, well, you know, sadly, like happens to a lot of people, Bud, you know, passed away. And I often wondered what happened to the amps, you know? And I ran into Peter at the Artisan Guitar Show in Harrisburg. And so he brought me up to date on what was going on, and these tiny little amps that are as loud and sound better than a Fender Twin, I was just blown away. So I managed to get myself my hands on as many of them as I can find.
Any particular one that you're liking right now?
The Bud is the one I use the most. I like, there's some new ones here, but I didn't get a chance to try them. There's one with a 10-inch speaker that seems, I'm just curious as to, you know, what it's like. And there's, I think you mentioned something with a tube head or just a preamp is tube?
Just a head.
A part of the preamp, I think.
Interesting. Okay.
And there's one with the thing that's great about the amp is it doesn't weigh very much. And the amp that I have, the model Bud that I have, he managed to reduce it by another few pounds.
Wow. Do you remember Polytone
mini group? Sure, yeah.
When I was a kid in New York, I think I was about 13 or 14, I used to put one on a backpack frame, and I used to go up on the 6 train up into Spanish Harlem to play salsa music on the, with that thing on my back.
Yeah, I knew Tommy Gamino pretty well when I lived in L.A.
Yeah?
Yeah.
It was a great amp. I mean, that's I'm talking 1974.
There was nothing around then. It was just...
not for that kind of thing.
There was every amp.
And that distortion was great.
Yeah, he had to do that, you know. He made the amp for himself because he played quarter box. And I don't know much about the electronics. The quarter box would seem to, you know, because you got a bass coming to the left hand, and this, it's a big sound. And it would always distort or overdrive the amp, so that made him, he made the thing
that
for
little
himself.
Red knob on the top of the volume knob was badass.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, put a little red knob.
It was great.
He was a fantastic accordion player, too.
Really?
Oh, yeah, really.
Is that a thing? No, I'm sorry.
No, very modern, like Art Van Damme. Okay. Very, you know, Joe Pass got interested in it, and they actually made a record together.
Yeah.
Early on in the company, you know.
And so the Henriksen amps for you, they're lightweight, big West sound.
Side, yeah.
You know, they're carrying. Do you feel that they carry on a stage like
so far? Not no
and
complaints.
None of that laser beam effect or
Mm-mm, no.
Interesting.
No, I've been using it now for maybe a year and a half.
Oh, fantastic!
You know, if I can drive to the venue, I always bring the amp.
Yeah.
Now I play a lot in New York mostly, and every club has not one but a few of those amps.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. Bruce Foreman got it into one club, Mesro, that I play sometimes.
I've heard great things about Mesro.
Yeah.
Isn't that where Pasquale Grasso?
Yeah.
Yeah, what a great young kid.
I just got turned on to him. Fantastic.
Yeah, I like him. Bud Powell. He's like Bud Powell on guitar.
Yeah, it's far out.
It's crazy, isn't it?
It's really far out. Yeah, we've been corresponding emails and stuff, so...
If people who are listening to this have not heard of this kid...
Yeah, you
got to go check him out. Yeah. He's worth hearing.
Yeah. Yeah, he's really saying something, I think.
So Peter contacted you and said, you know, I have this vision about this idea of an Archtop festival to bring people together, players and instruments. What were your thoughts?
Oh, I said, I'm there. Whatever you need, I want to come. Because I'm also playing Commons guitars now, too. And so I'm here via Bill and Peter. You know, Bill Commons is my neighbor.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you know.
I'll try and talk to him tomorrow. Yeah. We have a video crew coming tomorrow. We'll try and talk to everybody.
Yeah, and so, I mean, the timing, everything just worked out. I mean, I had a hole in my schedule. It just worked. You know, I've been, he called me, this has been in the works for a while, though, because I've had this in my book for, I don't know, 2-3 months, maybe more.
We came upon it. I live in Longmont, which is about an hour from here, and I stumbled on this, and I own a media company here. That's why we're doing this. And when the opportunity came to sponsor, I was like, I want to jump on this, because I used to have to go to NAMM a lot, and I'm not a big fan.
Me neither.
And, you know, it's like the idea of, like, good musicians and really serious craftsmen in a room.
Yeah.
Together, looking at serious stuff, really appealed to me.
Yeah, I mean, you know, some of those guitars down there, it's almost like walking through a museum.
Yeah,
you know, I'm afraid to play them. You know, but I mean, I think it's fantastic. You can get to, you know, talk to these guys that, you know, it's amazing to me how somebody can make an instrument. You know, all my favorite luthier friends are here. You know,
that's not a sentence a lot of people say. You know that, right?
Let's, yeah.
It's okay. No, do your thing.
There's a sneeze coming.
We can cut it if you need to.
It went away.
Nobody says that sentence very often. You know, I want you to hear that. You know, all of my good luthier friends are here.
Favorite luthier friends.
That's even better.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like a great thing.
Yeah.
And as a musician, so, you know, I was just talking to Bob Bakert from Jazz Guitar today.
Yeah.
We were talking about the sort of discrepancy, like, as a working musician, I've always owned Tellys and Strats, you know, obviously because you can get a great instrument, but at a price point under $3,000.
And they're indestructible.
To a degree.
Yeah.
You know, I'll show you my guitar when we're done with the interview.
Okay.
It's a nice little piece. The thing that we were talking about is that, you know, I've never owned an Archtop. Like, when I studied with Ted Green, he would lend me his Birdland, right? And that was the closest I've probably ever gotten. What are your thoughts about somebody, like, looking at the idea of wanting to acquire a fine instrument and understanding why you'd want to invest in something like this?
Well, you know, the guitar's hard to play anyway, you know. You need both sides of the equation. You need an instrument that's easy to play and that you like the way it sounds acoustically. And then the other side of the equation is, you know, that only works in your house. You need an amplifier. That's the other half of your instrument. I consider the amp. That's the part of the instrument. The guitar, you need a great amp.
Right.
So, and here, you know, all these luthiers here, they're all excellent. Every guitar is a little bit different. And some of them will tailor a guitar to whatever you're looking for. So I think it's, you know, and they're not all not... There's a lot of these people. They're not terribly expensive. They're not, you know, $40,000-$50,000. I don't think. I haven't seen one down there like that. That's, you know, in those kind of numbers. You know,
working guys. We were talking about
those
working
days
guys.
Are over.
Working guys at the, you know, that thing. I don't think personally. See, this is. I look at it this way. I think the instrument, the more the instrument can make it easy for you to say what you got to say.
That's it. Yeah.
The better the instrument is. You know, like I you know, I don't want to struggle with pickups. I don't want to struggle with the structure of the instrument. I want to be able to do what I want to do so that my mind and ears and hands are free.
Right. I don't want to fight the guitar.
Yeah.
About getting
the or
sound.
The amp.
Same thing with amps too. Amps could be very complicated. You know, I mean, the Hendrix is just very straight ahead.
Yeah.
You know.
But once it's in your hands, do you think it's there?
The knobs. You know,
I remember.
Electric, you know, amplifiers before, you know, you had bass, treble, and well, you really had to turn them a lot before you could hear. Did it change?
Yeah.
Not these. I mean, there's little clicks in there, and it makes a difference. Yeah. It actually worked. Those knobs, exactly.
You know? Well, I was saying, how much do you think the sound is in someone's hands before they even get to the instrument?
I think it's in your ear, and more than in your hands. I mean, you have this idea of what you want the guitar to sound like, and maybe I don't know whether it's in your hands. I've heard that before. An example people give is, well, you can get the same guitar, and here's player A playing it, and okay, now I'm going to play the same guitar and don't touch any of the knobs, and it sounds different.
Mm-hmm.
And that is true. I think that's the attack on the right hand. the pick, and also what kind of pick.
Huh, interesting.
You know, but I think it's in your mind's ear.
Interesting.
You know? And then you fiddle with the amp a little bit, and then I like to tweak the volume knob and the tone knob until I get it to what I think it should sound like.
Right. And in this particular genre, there's a lot of specific, I guess not archetypes, but like ways that the jazz guitar is expected to sound. I mean, it comes from that. I mean, I remember when I was a kid listening to Herb Ellis and Tal Farlow and Barney Kessel and Joe Pass.
Yeah.
They kind of set a standard for that sort of dark but rich sound that resonates.
And even those people mentioned, their guitars all sound differently.
Absolutely.
There's something that's the same about it, but there's, you know.
Herb Ellis, you instantly recognize Herb Ellis.
Yeah.
You know.
It's the, you know, type of lines that he plays and the sound, you know.
When I was a kid, I took a lesson with Herb. When I was a young kid in New York, and it was probably one of the best lessons I'd ever had.
Yeah, he was a very...
really sweet human.
No bullshit guy.
No bullshit.
You know, this is what I know.
See,
this
we cursed.
This is how I play. Yeah.
You did it. Yeah.
I mean, you know, that's the best way to describe
it. No bullshit.
You know, Joe Pass, the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, Joe was not the most articulate person when it came to describing musical terms and stuff like that, you know. I met him when I lived in L.A., and he says to me, he says, "Boy, man, Jimmy," he says, "these kids, they scare me at GIT. He says, "Why, Joe?" He says, "I don't know, man. They keep asking me about a Nickelodeon mode." I said, "Nickelodeon? No, Joe. It was a TV station, a cartoon, Nickelodeon." He says, "Well, what are they talking about, Nickelodeon?" And I says, "Well, it's the kind of the notes that bit of G7th. Oh,
that's really
guitar,
funny.
Oh, you mean this? And
he
just played all these fantastic lines, but they weren't. They didn't come from the Mixolydian mode. It came from his head."
Yeah, that's hysterical.
Yeah, it was really hysterical. I says, "Well, that's sort of what they mean."
Yeah,
you know.
I taught at MI for a while.
Yeah,
and I was teaching recording arts for guitar and some of the Ted Green stuff.
Yeah,
and it was really challenging because two things. One, when we were kids, when we were playing, if you wanted to learn something, you lifted the needle up, put it down, lifted up, put it down, and there was an effort involved. Now, you can sit down and some kid looks at YouTube and it's a microscopic examination of the guy's hands what he did and how he did it.
But you can't, you know, unless you can see what's in the guy's head musically, you can watch all you want. You're not going to really get it. It's a little hint of maybe what's happening, you know.
Yeah.
I think that a lot of young guys that are interested in playing this kind of music, I think their heads are too filled with too much information, too much theoretical information about what jazz is. And, you know, I always say, you know, the theory came after the music,
right?
Not before. Charlie Parker, you know, didn't know, I mean, there was no Dorian, I don't think so. I mean, I could be wrong, but that's before schools and all this other stuff. And look at Wes Montgomery, you know? I mean, people were telling me that when I was younger. Oh, you gotta learn all your modes and stuff. And I started to get transcriptions and listening to what Charlie, I still can play all the modes. Nobody ever made a, Joe Bass told me one time, he says, nobody ever made a CD of scales and modes.
Think about it as a conversation, right? Let's say you and I were talking right now, right?
Right.
And I was just looking at you and I was going, okay, I'm going to want you to pick out the letters, but you're going to know what I mean, okay? So A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P, Q, R, S, T, U, V.
Good analogy.
But I need you to know that what I was asking you about was, how you doing, bud?
Yeah, see, that's good analogy, you know? And I start listening to these records, and I couldn't find any of the music theory stuff.
There's
in
some
the
young
music.
Guys with theory deep that are like this kid Jacob Collier. Have you heard him?
Yeah.
He's a young virtuoso. He plays about 30 instruments.
Yeah.
But he's a very rich musician.
Yeah.
He's writing and arranging and composing, and he plays.
Well, see, that's a different thing. I studied that, you know, but from a classical perspective.
Right.
Now, that theory is a little bit different.
His is applicable. It's lot, that's what I like.
It is
applicable.
That's a lot more applicable.
It's not in his head.
Right.
It's in his ears, and it's in the way he's expressing music. Some of
see,
it's a little heavy for me.
See, here's how it started. Here's what I think it started. It was the common harmonic practices of the time.
Mm-hmm.
There's harmonic. Vincent Persichetti was what the guys used for harmonies in the 20th century music. There's a book about that. Fantastic book. Hindemith and all that stuff. It was mainly like, you know, what did Mozart do with these seven chords, okay? And he liked to do this. He liked to do this Formula 1-4, mm-hmm. you know? So jazz theory somehow, it started out like that, you know, with the basic 2-5, 2-5-1, and then it goes to four chord. Most of the time, if a tune goes to the four chord, the next chord is the four chord that's minor.
Mm-hmm.
See, those are, that. See, to me, that's useful. And I don't think that that's theory, that's fact.
See, but okay, so everything you just said, as you were saying it, this is gonna sound dorky, but in my head, I'm in B flat, and you were talking, so I was just in B flat. And I was thinking, okay, 2-5-1-4-4 minor 1. But I'm not thinking 2-2-5-1-4. I'm hearing
C minor seven, I'm hearing, F7, yeah, I'm B hearing, flat.
Or whatever the color extensions are, and when yeah. and that particular that emotive quality that, yeah. that change
now, in color. You know, the other thing too is that, you know, you mentioned the extensions and the alterations, and for some reason, I don't know how in the world of academia now, I'm not saying all schools. I mean, you know, when you go to a music school, the what matters is who is the person you're going to study with. That's what matters, you know, because they have syllabuses and stuff like that. So you go there because this guy, Mr. X there, you like the way he plays guitar. And so that's why you go to that school, you know. And I know a lot of people that do this, and, you know, most of these people, a lot of the schools started to reach out for people that have already made CDs, already have made names, and says, hey, why don't you come, you know, teach these kids, how, you know, what are you thinking about? You know, now some schools are more theory oriented, you know, and there's also a school of thought, oh, if you have G7 flat 9, you have to play this scale.
Oh.
You know, depending on the, no, that's not, that is,
but
really
it's color.
Right.
I mean, it's a lot of color and context. I mean, if you're talking like there's what's that lyric to jazz tune? The change from major to minor. It's there's like I'm thinking of a tune. Let me think. You'll Never Walk Alone, yeah. where it's 5 major, and to get to the next section of the tune, he goes 5 minor. But nobody would do that. But because of the way the melody
right.
moves yeah. in that particular moment of the song, yeah. you're on the 5 chord, but now it's a minor chord. And it's not going anywhere as a minor chord. It just needed to be that
yeah.
because the container of the melody had to go
went
there.
For the color went from bright to dark.
Yeah, and it had to because yeah. of the
and
way
the way you do
the
that,
lyric.
You lower to the third.
Yeah, and the melody and the context of where you were yeah. coming from. And yeah. the thing is, most like when I'm talking to musicians a lot lately, I'm not that interested in like the theoretical structure. I'm interested in how do I get from point A to point B so I know what the container is. Right?
Right.
I mean,
yeah.
I want to know what the container is because I want to have a conversation
yeah,
with you.
Yeah.
If we're going
to
play.
Know, the other thing, you know, music moves from left to right. It never stays still.
Yes.
You know, the only time music stops is at the end when it goes ta-da. Okay. Now the chord of the, that's the chord of there.
Yeah.
Okay. Now the vertical aspect of what you play matters a little more. But during the tune, it doesn't.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Charlie Parker, he'd have a dominant seventh chord, and he would flat the 9 of the dominant seventh, but a bar after the chord passed. The next chord might be a major, and he's still playing off the D7th.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
I think I hear his conversation. This is when I used to play a lot of blues for touring with good guys, good, yeah. really good players, and I used to get a question, well, why don't you want to sound like this guy or this guy, right?
Yeah.
And I would say, well, I don't want to have the same conversation that somebody else has already had.
Well, yeah,
I mean, it's
true,
like I want to have a conversation where we're talking about something in a different way and in a new
yeah.
in a way so that like what you hear and what I hear comes together as a conversation,
yeah.
right? And what I hear a lot is that there's a predilection for people to repeat what's already been said. Like the whole thing of licks, I don't understand licks.
Right,
I mean, that's just me. I don't understand licks. I mean, I understand it's a basics for vocabulary.
Well, it's a good place to start.
To start. So but you if you're improvising, if the goal is improvisation, maybe those are thought pauses, you know,
yeah.
to get from one sentence to the
yeah,
next.
Yeah, it could sometimes, you know.
You know, but
I mean,
playing.
As much as I like Wes Montgomery, you know, and I know lots of his solos note by note, but I don't sound like Wes Montgomery when I do it. Now I'm just a mirror of stuff that.
But you know that
played.
Conversation in your head.
Yeah.
You know if you were putting it in language, he told you the story of the three bears, right?
Yeah.
So he told you three bears. You know, this bed is too hard. This bed is too soft.
Yeah.
This bed's just right. When you get to that room. In the song, it's the same song,
right.
4-on-6 or whatever. Let's pick, that doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And you get to that point in the song, you know, well, I could do that, but I also know why he was doing that. And I have my own language and I can approach it from that point of view.
Yeah, the harmonic function of the chords is still the same.
I want to sit here and talk to you all day, but we don't have time. Because, I mean, this is the kind of thing that I think about a lot, and it's as a musician, as a producer, these are the kinds of things I'm interested in, the human component.
It's very complicated, you know? I mean, really, to understand, I learn stuff every day.
Exactly.
You know, I find something new all the time.
Exactly. Let's talk a little bit about the festival. What do you see for the future, because this is the first year, about how do we support and how does the future of the Rocky Mountain Art Show, I think,
to get the word out, tell your friends about it, because this is a very worthwhile endeavor, and it's not often where you can get see all these fine guitarists, jazz musicians, and also all the fine guitar makers, and there's Pete with the missing link. You've got to have the amplifier. You know, otherwise you'd just be playing in your room. You can't work.
Which is what a lot of guys are doing anyway.
Yeah.
So we got to get them out and seeing great musicians, great teachers, great amplifier makers, great guitar makers.
And they're all here.
And this is the first year, so it's just going to grow.
Some of my heroes are here. I mean, Bruce Foreman, I haven't seen him in a long time. Bobby Broom, who I just met briefly in New York, got to hear him play. And Linda Manzer.
Oh my goodness, big
fan of hers for
Linda
30 Manzer's years
an extraordinary
ago,
luthier.
You know, and of course Bill. You know, I get used to Bill because I see him every day. He lives near me. We go to breakfast. You know, but I mean, yeah, Bill is a fine maker. And there's Roger Stadowski's here.
And when I was a kid in New York, that was where I go to get my guitars repaired.
Yeah, Roger, he was.
Is he here?
Yeah, he's at the show.
I didn't know that.
He's got lots of real fine guitars there.
I should go say
he was the only one that made a Jimmy Bruno model.
That's fantastic. Are you in New York actually proper or?
No, I'm in Abington, Pennsylvania.
Okay, yeah. Pennsylvania. You go up to New York to play?
Yeah, it's not that far.
Is there anything you want people who are listening to know about what you're doing? Records, website?
Well, I've got the best source is jimmybruno.com, my website.
jimmybruno.com.
Yeah, okay. I also have an online school, but that doesn't. JBGW, I forget the. If you go to jimmybruno.com, the link is there.
Okay.
But that, that I can. I answer those videos. Sometimes I can be traveling and I can answer the videos. It's like people send me a clip of, hey, you know, am I playing this right, et cetera, like that. But the touring thing is just at jimmybruno.com, and it's just recently. I've gotten so busy, I hate to say this, but maybe a little bit too busy, that I get to the job and I don't have time to update the website. Like, this was, you know, I never did put this on my website, but it was all, I put it all on my Facebook page.
All right, well, folks, there's Jimmy Bruno Facebook page, there's jimmybruno.com.
Yeah.
We're incredibly grateful to have you at the Rocky Mountain Art Shop Festival here, 2019. We're going to hope you're going to be coming to all the ones coming up. I'm really honored to have been able to spend a little time.
Yeah, I think Pete's doing great. Peter's doing a marvelous thing here, and I hope it gets a... Well, so far, turnout looks great to me.
It's pretty amazing, I think, for the first time, tons of people.
It looks like it will happen again next year.
I'm really grateful you took the time to talk with
me. Thanks, John.
I will look forward to talking with you again.
Okay.
And thank you. All right.
Came out good.